honor to be with you. I'm grateful for the participation of people less than 60. We held this meeting, we held our first meeting in Richfield on Thursday night. And we had on the front row, we only had 23 people. That's because we've never been to Richfield and have no friends there, no association with. We're going to build a group there where we can bring out 100, like you're doing here. And on the front row was a bright, intelligent-looking young man. And his mother whispered to me that that was her son. I could tell she had a certain amount of, a good feeling about pride, I was going to say, but that's, be careful about that word. She was pleased with her son. And then she also pointed out that his grandmother was over on the other side of the room. So we had three of the family there. And the mother played the piano for our closing number. And then the son came up afterwards. And when we got done visiting for 2 or 3 minutes, I said, it was worth coming to... I didn't say it to him. But to myself, I said it was worth coming to Richfield just to meet this one young man. 17 years old. He loves the Constitution. He's a devoted disciple of freedom. At age 17, because of a mother and a grandmother. And I said something, and he said, well, I like to speak in public. You do? Yes, I won 2 speech competitions. Actually, they were 2 State of Utah debate competitions. He won twice. I said, how would you like to speak next month? And so next month in Richfield, he will join me. And he will speak on defining the union. I gave him the assignment that I've offered to you in the hope that some of you will turn in a written report, 1 paragraph or less. Define the union after you read the assignment. And you go to the website. Do you remember getting that last month? You go to the website, to libertyandlearning.com, and on the home page, you'll find the challenge and the assignment, a heuristic exploration of the union. Do it. It is the most fundamental research from primary sources that any American could be expected to do. And when you're done, if you don't have a new concept, I will really be surprised. If you don't say, is that what the union is? Or some other dramatic, feeling inside your soul, I will really be surprised, because that's what happened to me. When I went through those sources, I gasped. I knew that the whole entire, my life, I had never understood the simple term, the union. Try it out, and I hope you'll like it. Okay, this evening we're going to talk about government by judiciary. From rule of law to social Darwinism. And always, every time before I start, I always think, I wonder if an evening will ever be perfect with everything working. And already this wasn't turned on just then. So here we try again, okay? Government by judiciary. We broke the sound barrier. And we got that figured out. So we have a microphone adjustment back here now. Okay, we introduced you last month to this book, The 5,000-Year Leap. Jim Norlander communicated with me this month after the lessons, and he said that ought to be the foundation book for this kind of people, the basic doctrine of American good government, those 28 great principles of the founding fathers that we've gathered and put into one cover. And so I'm honored to have been a part of that research and to have my name in there as the one that wrote the new foreword. So we remind you again that this is back here. We ran out last time. We brought 50 more, and that should cover this group tonight. So we have a case and a half of the 5,000-year leap. Showing the rising sun. That is not a setting sun. That is a rising sun, and we mentioned last month Ben Franklin's great statement about the rising sun. So we want to make it rise again in America. Tonight we're going to focus on this book for this first lesson, Betrayed by the Bench. John Stormer, I visited with him 3 times in the last month, and just a fine American. He's about, I think he said he was 78 years old. And he wrote, None Dare Call It Treason. If you remember many years ago, that very, very popular bestseller. And he says of this book, sales are not going well. He doesn't understand why, but it hasn't hit the bestseller list yet. And so we're trying to help him. So we've moved to nearly 200 in the last month. That's we hope, doing something for his enthusiasm. He's a grand, grand man. He teaches religion at a prison in Missouri. I believe, as I recall, he said he was a pastor or ordained minister of some church back in Missouri. All I know is that I felt good when I visited with him, and he's our contributor for tonight. Now, we're going to use a few visual aids, and we're preparing you for next month. Next month's lesson has a hand in it that's real. And we're going to liken the country to some of these fingers and things. Let's see how this works out here. You know, the hand is a very beautiful part of the body. If you think about it, all these little beautiful things you can do with that hand, what a marvelous invention, creation, we should say. And I laid my hand on a piece of paper, and I drew this because I thought, we're going to liken the United States of America to a hand, a correctly functioning hand. Everything is there. It's all working correctly. And we're going to call this pointer finger the sovereign states. And it doesn't matter how many they are. The finger, the pointer finger, represents the sovereign states, and they are pointing the right direction. Now, they're free and independent states. This is, we're going back to the original. This is how we started. These free and independent states organized, they sent delegates to a convention, and those delegates, representing their states, created a constitution, a plan by which we could govern ourselves. Some believe it was the greatest plan of government ever written in the history of the world. That plan included dividing the power up between the legislative, the executive, and the judicial branches. And the judicial branch, on purpose, is the little pinky down at the bottom. Now, why did we put it down there? Isn't the Supreme Court the mighty Supreme Court? Aren't they supposed to be the ones that determines what the Constitution means? What we say is what it means. You've heard that before. That was what Earl Warren declared, and Warren Burger, and a long list of other judges. Well, no, it's a little pinky down at the bottom. When the Supreme Court gives an opinion, it is not law. It's just an opinion. Now, we're going to read from the Federalist Papers. If you haven't caught on yet, this is the condensed version. The first time I did this 3 years ago, I gave the long version, and they came faithfully. We had about 50 to 70 students in Fillmore, and they just came regular, week after week after week. And finally, in 14 weeks, I said, how long do you think we should go on? Well, forever, I guess. I says, we're cutting this off in 2 weeks. So we went 16 weeks. Can you imagine how much? 3 hours a night. And it was wonderful. And that helped me to gather together a body of material, and then we kept boiling it down because it's hard for me to go out 16 weeks everywhere. And some of you don't want to spend 16 weeks in the classroom. And so we boiled this down, and what we have here is three times we get together, and then we try to get you to learn how to go out and do your own if you're not doing it. Learn how to do your own reading and your research. And so that assignment we've given you on heuristic exploration of the Union, I'm serious. I want you to do that without me being here urging you or entertaining you. Got the idea? Okay. In the Federalist Papers, we have these three characters. This is one of the most basic sources for what the Constitution means. It has its errors, it has its flaws, but it's one of the most wonderful support documents to explain the Constitution. And Alexander Hamilton said it like this in Federalist Paper number 78. The judiciary is beyond comparison the weakest of the three departments of power. Now, there's a lot more said on it. That's not the only quote, but that's why we use the little pinky to represent the judiciary. They are the weakest of the three branches of government. They were never intended to be equal. You've heard that, haven't you? You've heard them say, oh, we have three equal branches, the legislative, the executive, and the judicial. Find anywhere in the primary sources where that's the case. I do not believe you can. That's an invention of modern historians, an aoristic creation. Do you remember that word from last time? Okay, aoristic. Tending to want to win a victory by using words in a war, erring in writing history. Okay. In contrast to heuristic history, where we're trying to find out what is the truth, and historians can write from either one or the other perspective, or perhaps a mixture, which is very confusing. Now, this is a bench. This evening's book that we're focusing on is called Betrayed by the Bench. Notice this is not the bench. Which bench is this? A bench. A bench. What is a bench? Well, it's this platform in between the judge, see the judge sitting back there, and the lawyer out here. This is the bench. And they're arguing a case. And we have the jurors over here, and we have the various people in the courtroom. Betrayed by the bench is referring to the judges that sit behind the bench. Now, this judge is not the judge that betrayed us. Quite on the contrary, this judge is Sir William Blackstone. Now, Sir William Blackstone was a contemporary of the Founding Fathers. They loved him. He was an English judge, but when he wrote his book, The Commentary on the Laws, It was more widely read in America than it was in England. And the American founders quoted Sir William Blackstone to make their case. And often the courtroom was settled when they would quote Sir William Blackstone. Both sides would agree, that's the law. And they would go ahead and abide by it. So this man had a great influence in everything but hairstyle. In his book, he writes, "Man as a creature must necessarily be subject to the laws of his Creator. This will of his Maker is called the law of nature. No human laws are of any validity if contrary to this." Now that should be a very thought-provoking statement. If man tries to pass a law, and they say, this is the law, and it's contrary to the laws of our Creator, then Sir William Blackstone said it's not a law at all. It's null and void right from the beginning. There's another gentleman much earlier in time that had the same belief. His name was Cicero, 65 BC. A legislative majority may pass laws that contradict the natural law, but these no more deserve to be called laws than the rules a band of robbers might pass in their assembly. So if the mafia gets together in Chicago and they decide what the law is, does that make it the law, even though might makes right? No, that's not the law. And the same thing if the legislature in Salt Lake City gets together and they pass a law that violates the laws of nature, is that a law? Not according to these great men of the past. Now that's all different now, but we're going to talk about that this evening. Now this I'm bringing up because these men make mention of the rule of law. And also, if I don't have it here tonight, I'll bring you an excellent handout on the Security and Prosperity Partnership of North America, better known now as the North American Union. If you're not up to speed on what this is something we need to know about. So what they're doing here, these three leaders of nations, they're agreeing on something that they didn't consult with the Congress about. They're agreeing to do certain things that they agreed upon by themselves, without consulting the people's representatives. This is a good source for that, but here's what we want to focus on. President Bush answered a reporter on the question of the North American Union, saying, "As to what kind of union might there be, I see one based upon commitment to democracy and rule of law." Okay, now, if we're going to have a North American Union, and these three men are determining it, They're going to determine what we're going to do, and they're going to determine it's going to be a democracy and it's going to be rule of law. Well, we want to focus on rule of law, but I can't pass democracy up without mentioning once again that Karl Marx wrote about democracy in the Communist Manifesto. And what did he say about democracy? Why, he said that's the first step to communism. Oh, we say, we're taking democracy to the world. We might as well say we're taking communism to the world, socialism. It's just another way of saying the same thing. The resulting effect of what we call democracy is bad. Find me any reference in a primary source where the founding fathers gave a positive statement about democracy. Find one. They're not there. Quite on the contrary, they denounce democracy as a less than desirable form of government. So why in the world would we want to take democracy to the world? Now, there's an excellent chapter in the 5,000-year leap summarizing the history of democracy. There's also an excellent publication by Robert Welch up here on the table called Democracies and Republics. And both of those will help you to grasp and be able to explain to your friends the difference between a democracy and a constitutional republic. I, in fact, enjoyed, I've often heard people criticize one of the quotations in both of those publications. They quote the Army Training Manual of 1928, and for some reason I hear enough people give me feedback and they say, oh, that's too good to be true, it can't really say that. It denounces democracy in the Army Training Manual of 1927. Oh, last week, 2 weeks ago it's been now, I went to the library where we had obtained on interlibrary loan the Army Training Manual of 1927. If I may correct, there's an error of 1 year in the book. Robert Welch doesn't give the reference at all. He just says the Army Training Manual. And so you're left wondering which one, when, and where. It is there. I read the original. I had to do a strip search, going strip stark naked, no pens, pencils, or anything. You know, this is the secured area of the library. And what am I looking at? The Citizenship Manual of 1927. It was good reading. Among other things, it gave this definition of democracy that is so succinct and clear, and it is the same definition that you will find in the 5,000-year leap in chapter 12, or principle number 12, and you'll also find in Robert Welch's excellent presentation, Democracies and Republics. It is a correct statement. Now let's look at the rule of law. What is the rule of law? What is this barn? What does that have to do with our evening's lesson? This is the first Supreme Court building. Here's where they held forth in the beginning and practice the rule of law. Now let's put a definition up here. Try and come up with what we mean when we say that. It's quite different than the one I'm sure that George W. Bush was using. The definitions won't be the same. Here's the definition. I wrote this definition myself. It's my definition gathered from the screening and the readings that I do. Because the United States is a constitutional republic, both the people and their elected leaders observe the limitations imposed by a written constitution, which is solidly founded on the laws of nature and of nature's God. Now consider that as a good definition. If you'd like to alter it, send it to me in writing and I'll modify it if it appeals to me. But I believe we've got the essence of the rule of law. So the rule of law doesn't mean we have lawmakers that make any old whimsical rule that they want. It means that we have lawmakers and people who abide by a written constitution which is founded upon the laws of nature and of nature's God. And any deviation from the laws of nature and of nature's God is a violation of the rule of law. Have we said that clearly? Or there's the alternate here. If we have rule of law, we will also have the opposite, which we will call rule of lawmakers. Now, this definition comes out of the Army Training Manual of 1952. And you won't believe they're both in Robert Welch's story, and they're both in that publication. Don't go home without one tonight. You need to read the Army Training. I don't know who writes training manuals. The military has somebody assigned to that. And it's the Citizenship Manual, teaching the new recruits what citizenship in America means. So in 1927, they had this great presentation on the evils of democracy. But in 1952, this is the definition from the Army Training Manual. Notice the Department of Army Field Manual, June 1952. Because the United States is a democracy, the majority of the people decide how our government will be organized and run. The people do this by electing representatives, and these men and women then carry out the wishes of the people. How do you like that definition? Well, it's nothing like the one they wrote 25 years before, or whatever the number of years was. How did we evolve from the 1927 version to the 1952 version, which is the version we're still following? How did we evolve from rule of law to rule of lawmakers? Now, this next picture is going to be a startling picture. It's a picture of your great-great-great-grandmother. You didn't know we had a genealogical picture for each of you here tonight, did you? I'm going to show how we evolved. That's slime. That's what that is. That's slime. And it humors this, and I still chuckle when I look at this. Well, a long time ago when I was a youth, I remember somebody telling me that out somewhere in the universe, eons of infinite time ago, there were particles floating around. They bumped into each other and they fell into a tepid primeval sea. And after eons of infinite time, a lizard crawled out from under a rock, and that was your great-grandmother. That's what they told me. Didn't you get a version of something like that? Yeah. I see heads nodding. Yes, you did. You know you did. Because I see it in the this is the high school textbook of Fillmore High School. Now, they may have changed. This is one 10 years ago. I can't keep up. I don't know what the newest one has, but I promise you it isn't going the other direction. This is right out of the textbook, except for the words human evolution, which I put in with the PowerPoint program. Their whole story is about human evolution, and this creature right here was your ever-so-great-grandparent, and on down millions of years ago, and finally I was in Neanderthal. I saw this statue of this guy. I was there in the cave where they found him. Oh man, they have this stone statue standing there. It looks just like that. And we go, and the tourists go, and they look at this and think, wow, just think, that's what Grandpa looked like years ago. And here we are today. Well, okay, this sounds humorous. I don't know how many people, I think everyone in the nation's taught this in school, this concept. What's it got to do with law? Everything. Everything. We'll go on here. I went to the prison by assignment a few years ago, and I was assigned a week's research in the Utah State Penitentiary. I was there every evening from 4 until midnight. And I went into different cell blocks and participated as a researcher. The warden said, you can go anywhere you want, do anything you want, just don't pretend you're a prisoner or they'll kill you. I thought, well, that's not too hard. Okay. And then he also said, you haven't experienced research in the prison until you've done a cell count at 3 a.m. by yourself. Oh, okay. So 3 a.m. comes around, special shift for me that night, and the guard that's supervising my behavior, he says, now here's how you do it. You go down through the cells by yourself, and you have to see skin. Doesn't count if you just see a lump under the blanket. You've got to see skin. That means you've got to reach in and lift the blanket up and look. There is a body under that blanket. Well, that was an interesting evening. In that experience, I met an inmate that was helpful, very kind and helpful, and he drew this drawing for me. I said, draw me a picture of a person that looks like he has no point in life. He thinks his parents are nothing more than a bit of flotsam. You know, I gave him this kind of an assignment. Well, this is what he drew. Oh, he says, you mean just a common street criminal. That's what you're talking about. And so he drew me a common street criminal. And I put the caption up there, you are nothing but a particle of flotsam washed up from a tepid primeval sea. Isn't that disgusting? That makes you feel creepy, cruddy, slimy. Here he is again, same artist, depicting this common street criminal. And I thought, well, it wasn't too many years ago. If he really believes that he's a piece of slime, it wasn't too many years ago that his cousin could have been walking the street with him. What's this got to do with the law? Now let's quote one of the nation's foremost Supreme Court judges, one of the greatest of the Supreme Court judges, Oliver Wendell Holmes, Jr. I see no reason for attributing to man a significance different in kind from that which belongs to a baboon or a grain of sand. How would you like that man making your law? He did. With this belief that man evolved from a lower form of life over eons of infinite time, it was not hard then for people to conclude that man is the center of the universe. Because we have achieved this great accomplishment of coming up to this level of evolution that we were taught, and they artistically created man as the center of the universe. Now, we're going to keep pounding. We're talking about the law. Beware of smooth talk. Are you able to see good right there?
I can.
Because lots of other choices. We're glad you're here. These men and others, this is just an example. Beware of smooth talk. If I haven't told you before, there are three things which we should beware of, and they're all represented right here on this screen. Smooth talk is what I put in as a blacksmith, because when I looked up the word, oh, come on, what's the word that I cheated on here? Beware of, I know the second one, false education, flattery. Beware of the flattery of prominent men. That was the warning I read from a man that I loved and respected. Beware of flattery. And I always thought that meant, my, what beautiful eyes you have, you know. But that isn't it at all. I finally caught on, but I did it by studying the word. I went to the dictionary, and it said flattery comes from the word flatter. And flatter comes from the word flatter. That was really helpful. Because I'm a blacksmith, and I own a flatter. A flatter is a tool. It's a tool for smoothing. And so if you smooth metal with your flatter, then somebody applied that to human behavior. Flatter means to smooth talk in human behavior. And so, oh, I got that. I'm a blacksmith. I can grasp that. So I put beware of smooth talk instead of beware of the flattery of prominent man. It's the same thing. These are prominent men. There are many more we could put up there. We have Charles Darwin, Herbert Spencer. This is a long list. The second one to beware of. Beware of false educational ideas. Now, these prominent men, they're distinguished. They're in high positions of leadership. And they'll say things they may even believe are true. But they're false in some cases. False educational ideas. Now, the third one to beware of, we can give credit down here to this unknown character. Oops, I didn't mean to do that. To this unknown character here, Alfred Kinsey. Most of us have never heard of him before. They made a new movie about him, about how good he is. Just came out not too many years ago. You've heard about the movie. Alfred Kinsey, then, is the one we can give credit for this third warning. Beware of, what do you think it's going to be? Sexual impurity. And Alfred Kinsey is the father of modern America's sexual impurity. And as you do your homework, you'll see his name more often now as you do your reading and thinking about this bit of history. What do we have, this terrible thing going across the nation now with no moral standards? What happened? Where did the sexual moral standards go? They're all awash. They were washed away by that evil man right there. Oh, forgive me, I don't know if he's evil or not. That man that used poor judgment, made bad choices. That sounds better, doesn't it? He sounds pretty evil when you read about him, though. Now, fact. Warping the Constitution undermines the rule of law. All of these men I just put up there have, for various reasons, participated in the warping of the Constitution. I like this old book, 1857, Trial by Jury. And that would be an enjoyable evening to have an evening on that topic. What does it mean to have trial by jury? It no longer is functioning correctly. But here he speaks of something else. Constitutions are utterly worthless to restrain the tyranny of governments unless it be understood that the people will, by force, compel the government to keep within the constitutional limits. Have you ever heard anybody say, our Constitution guarantees our rights? Ever heard that before? Yeah, we all said that, or we've all heard somebody say it. Does it guarantee our rights? I've got friends that lay the Bible on the coffee table in the front room. Does that guarantee their behavior? Okay, let's try Lysander Spooner on another page. Practically speaking, no government knows any limits to its power except the endurance of the people. How long will we stand by and let the government run over us roughshod before we finally say enough is enough and we start taking action to try and solve the problems? This is what Sophie Scholl did. Sophie Scholl last month's lesson. Sophie Scholl stood up to the government. She defied the government. She tried to do it in secret. She probably would have had her life still had she been able to keep it a secret. But it was spilled. You remember last month? She was one of the students handing out leaflets. And those leaflets were trying to explain the corruption of the government that was taking over Germany. Here's Sophie Scholl. In memory of Sophie Scholl, died at age 21, executed by guillotine in Hitler's Germany. Here was an example we read last week. Let's read it again. This is what she was handing out. Why do you allow these men who are in power to rob you step by step, openly and in secret, of one domain of your rights after another? Why? And for this and other things that she said that were quite beautiful, she was executed. This man is a very famous justice, John Marshall. Between 1801 and 1835, he served on the Supreme Court. He was the one we attribute the doctrine of judicial review to, power assumed by Justice John Marshall in the 1803 case of Marbury versus Madison, whereby the court could invalidate statutes of Congress based upon the court's viewpoint of original understanding of the Constitution. Well, Congress could have stood up then if they would have. They had the authority to, but they didn't. They just pretty well rolled with his decision. And from then on, notice how long it's been. How long have we stood by and let the Supreme Court run the nation's lawmaking system? Huh? Is there any other way? Do you mean you're suggesting it wasn't that way in the beginning? The beginning in 1803 is almost the beginning. No, it wasn't that way in the beginning. and we'll show you an example of what we're trying to help learn here. Let's go to the example of the Citizenship Boy Scout Manual. A few weeks ago, not very long ago, I was asked to speak to a group of scout leaders. I was supposed to talk about the Citizenship in the Nation merit badge. I had never seen the manual before, and I think two nights before I was supposed to speak, they brought me the manual. Oh, I'm supposed to read and digest these 40 pages in two nights and come and give a talk on it. Well, it wasn't too hard. I opened the manual up to the first page, and the second sentence was false, blatantly false. Well, do I need to go any further? I went through and I flagged 18 red flags, 18 places where the manual had serious problems. I'm going to give you one of them. This is the one that pertains to the evening's topic here. Tell me what you think of this. The Supreme Court has the final authority to interpret the meaning of the Constitution and determine if the law is being applied correctly and fairly. True or false? I hope you said false. If you said true, let me give you this example and see if you still think true after I'm done. Suppose the Supreme Court came along and they said, we decided that we find in the Constitution, we find the right to commit sodomy. Would you then say that this is a good thing for the Boy Scouts to believe? That the Supreme Court is this wonderful organization that determines what the Constitution means if they make a decision like that? They did that in the year 2003 in the case of Lawrence versus Texas. Now, how many more examples do you want me to give before you finally say, no, they don't have the final authority? We don't want them to have the final authority. They have usurped the power to do that. It was not granted to them. Back to the hand. The United States of America, the sovereign states, free and independent sovereign states pointing the way, organized a constitutional convention. From that, they created the legislative, the executive, and the judicial branch. The fact of legislative supremacy, oh, you mean the legislature is even above the executive branch? Yes, they were originally intended to be the supreme of the three. And let's show how that works. In other words, the legislature has power over the executive and judicial branches. For example, Congress controls the purse strings. Okay, what can you do without money if we cut off your money supply? Can you fight the Vietnam War if you don't have any money? That was an example where Congress finally started restricting the money flow. Congress has the power to create federal courts and hence the power to abolish them. How long will your court last if Congress says, we don't want you anymore, you're abolished? They can do it. They have that authority in the Constitution. Congress has the power to restrict appeals to the Supreme Court. This is a powerful tool. And Congress can impeach rogue justices. We will remove you from office for your failure to uphold the Constitution. That's what they can do. Have they ever done this? Seldom. Let's give you an example. On restricting appeals to the Supreme Court, here's one we can readily understand. Article 2, Section 2 of the Constitution, briefly stated, is the Supreme Court shall have appellate jurisdiction with such exceptions and under such regulations as the Congress shall make. Now, we'll give you an example. Remember the Pledge of Allegiance controversy not very many years ago? Pledge Protection Act of 2004, House Resolution 2028, passed by 247 to 173. It means we've got a huge, massive majority that said, no court created by act of Congress shall have jurisdiction, and the Supreme Court shall have no appellate jurisdiction to hear or decide cases pertaining to the Pledge of Allegiance. You see how that worked out so beautifully to control a court that was out of order? Congress can do that on any appeal that goes to the Supreme Court. Oh, think of that power now. But they're a bunch of wimps, and they don't act. This effort to try and get the court to make decisions is not a new thing. We can remember FDR and his effort to pack the court. That was the term. He wanted to assign more justices, trying to get more that would vote his way. The court, instead of being rule of law, were rule of lawmakers. And he was trying to get a majority on his political side of the fence so that they could continue to put his programs into effect. Well, it turned out he didn't need to. They went ahead with these programs in many cases anyway, not all of them, but in many cases. I want to make mention of this old lawyer. None of the lawyer jokes apply to him. He's a great, great American. He's probably the smartest guy that ever came out of Utah, if not the smartest, one of the smartest. Great Utah stock. When he graduated and went out into the world, he eventually became Under Secretary of State in 1928, back in that period. He became ambassador to Mexico. He ran law firms in two of the major cities of the United States. He was internationally renowned. When lawyers had a convention, he was the lawyer that they would call upon to speak. He had gained their respect by many years of statesmanship. Honest, decent, wise statesmanship, in contrast to politicians wheeling and dealing. He stood up in Salt Lake City in 1942, and he said, "You have heard all your lives that the day would come when the Constitution would hang by a thread. I do not know if it now hangs by a thread or by a small rope, but whether it lives or dies is now in the balance." That was in 1942. He was one of the nation's foremost authorities on constitutional law. He gave more than 125 speeches on the topic, usually to lawyers, conventions, and groups. And now he says, if it isn't hanging by a thread, it's hanging by a small rope, one or the other. In 1942, what has happened since then? That's his book, by the way, the collection of his speeches. Now let's come up to 1990. Here's another great lawyer. I hold him in high respect. He's still alive, I believe. Haven't heard about him lately, but last I heard he was still kicking. Is he alive still? Probably in some think tank thinking somewhere. He was nominated by President Ronald Reagan to the Supreme Court. Now it's important. That's one of the most important duties a president has, is nominating people for the Supreme Court. And then the Senate is to consider the nomination and vote upon it. This is the constitutional procedure. He was nominated. And the Senate, some of them in the Senate, decided they didn't like him. And you'll see in a moment why. And after they raised $12 million to fight against having him seated, they won, and he was not seated in the court. $12 million. He wrote this book telling the story of how he was treated by the Senate. And that's the tempting of America. If I had lots of space and money and strength, I'd bring those books along and stack them on the table too. I'm going to read a line or two out of his testimony here. Page 300. It answers the question, how should a judge go about finding the law? Now, in his book, he's quoting from his testimony before the Senate. How should a judge go about finding the law? The only legitimate way, in my opinion, is by attempting to discern what those who made the law intended. If a judge abandons intention as his guide, there is no law available to him, and he begins to legislate a social agenda for the American people. That goes well beyond his legitimate power. He or she then diminishes liberty instead of enhancing it. When a judge goes beyond his proper function and reads entirely new values into the Constitution, values the framers and the ratifiers did not put there, he deprives the people of their liberty. That liberty, which the Constitution clearly envisions, is the liberty of the people to set their own social agenda. That's pretty good stuff, isn't it? He goes on, my philosophy of judging, Mr. Chairman, as you pointed out, is neither liberal nor conservative. It is simply a philosophy of judging which gives the Constitution a full and fair interpretation. But where the Constitution is silent, leaves the policy struggles to the Congress, the President, the legislatures, and executives of the 50 states and to the American people. Oh, if it isn't in the Constitution, then the judge has no authority to deal with it. And he leaves it up to the people and the local and state governments. Oh, now that's one reason why they voted not to have him be on the Supreme Court. Let me give you another example. Page 174. Those who drafted, proposed, and ratified the Constitution meant it to be the law. That is why Article 6, Clause 2 states, "This Constitution shall be the supreme law of the land." Even those who opposed the adoption of the Constitution did not suggest, after it had been ratified, that it was not law. Clause 3 continues, "The senators and representatives before mentioned, and the members of the several state legislatures, and all executive and judicial officers, both of the United States and of the several states, shall be bound by oath or affirmation to support this Constitution." Don't be sleepy. Wake up now. This is good stuff. I was talking to you. Oh, no, I'm just teasing you. Once in a while I make mistakes, and last time I made a mistake by saying wake up to somebody, and I'm afraid they'll never come again. Anyway, he's going on here. He just said something really critical, and he's going to play on this word "this." They made an oath to support what? This Constitution. Now, here's what he says about that. This Constitution, and he writes this in italics, "This Constitution, not one they make up themselves, is to bind federal judges. And they are bound to the same thing that senators and representatives are bound to, along with all state officers, legislators, and judges. It would be extremely odd if all these functionaries are equally bound, but one set of them, the federal judges, is authorized to keep changing what it is everybody is bound to. That would mean, contrary to the text, that federal judges are not bound, and all other classes of persons mentioned are bound to the judges and not to the Constitution." Do you get it? Powerful. So they voted, no, we don't want that kind of a man on the court. Why? Because he said it just this clear, if you put me on the Supreme Court, I will honor and uphold the original intent of the Constitution. And original intent is no way today to win votes. Well, that's an example then of a great current lawyer. And then he updates that book with more information in 1996. Why don't you shift over a seat or two here? I'm so fat. You want to? Can you see the screen? Feel free to, please. Just shift over a seat or two. I looked at that tonight sitting there, and I thought, I hope nobody sits in the corner. Thank you. I'm happy now. In 1996, he wrote another book. And I give credit to a dear, dear lady named Jewel Skousen for suggesting I read this book, and I want to thank her publicly. She's still alive and well right here in Salt Lake City. I went to visit her husband, and he was ill that day, and so Mrs. Skousen and I sat in the front room and chatted, and she says, "Have you read the book Slouching Toward Gomorrah?" "No, I've never heard of it before." "Well, you really need to read the book." And so I did. And it was one of the more valuable books in grasping current events and current problems, again from this wise old judge in 1996, and the name says it, Slouching Towards Gomorrah. He's talking about the United States of America. Is that a descriptive title? Slouching Toward Gomorrah. And then he updates that book in 2003. Now, that's getting pretty close to today. In 2003, in the afterword, he writes, quoting another federal judge. So we have, he himself was a prominent federal judge for a time. Now he quotes another prominent federal judge, so that's kind of like two witnesses. And they say the Constitution is simply gone. Well, in 1942, this great lawyer stands up and says it's perhaps hanging by a rope or a small thread or one or the other. And now this judge says, it's gone. If the Supreme Court can do what they did in the case of Lawrence versus Texas, then there is no constitutional limitation on the court. Well, frankly, we already knew that from previous decisions, but he made that a public statement in his text or his book. Where did it go? Where did it go? I've got 50 or 100 copies up here on the table. It's not gone, is it? Well, yeah. The paper document's still there. It's kind of like the Bible laying on my friend's table. It's still there, but who's following it? We changed our behavior in government. And so even though we still have in the archives in Washington, D.C., a very protected piece of paper that we have big thick glass over and have armed guards standing around, even though it's there, it got changed. And because it got changed, it's the same as not having one at all. And so we can say it's gone. And we're going to go, oh, we won't open it for discussion, but you can have questions at the break or afterwards. But I hope we've stirred you up to thinking. Where did the Constitution go? Back on the table, there's an excellent little publication called How Tyranny Came to America. Take a copy home. If you can donate a buck or two, do it. If you can't, just take it, if there are any left. Or if there aren't any, go to Sobran.com on the internet and read the same thing. Sobran.com, that's where we obtained the booklet. The United States Constitution poses no serious threat to our form of government today. Yeah, that's thought-provoking, isn't it? Now, this is a political caricature. I think they've done it accurately. As Justice William Brennan throws the Constitution into the garbage can, he says, "This junk was obviously written by a bunch of right-wing kooks." Have you ever considered who thinks you're a right-wing extremist if you think that you believe the original Constitution? This is where they put you, in the category of a right-wing kook. I'm not a kook. I believe in the Constitution according to the original intent. Let them say what they may. Casting aside justice is what they've done. Now, just since we last met, in the last month, I received the case of Diet versus Turner and added it to this presentation. I received it from a lawyer in Maryland who thought that I would be interested because the case took place in Utah Supreme Court. And he just thought maybe I'd like to hear that the Utah court made a wise decision. And I did. It was wonderful reading. So those are all the particulars if you want to read the case. And by the way, this, I believe, is posted on our website, libertyandlearning.com. So if you don't write all that down, I think you can pull it up. And if it's not there, it'll be there soon. I keep adding to the site. Here's an example of what we can read in Diet versus Turner. This is the Utah Supreme Court speaking, a unanimous decision. "The United States Supreme Court, as at present constituted, has departed from the Constitution as it has been interpreted from its inception, and has followed the urgings of social reformers in foisting upon this nation laws." Now, we don't need to go on. Is this some right-wing kook speaking? Some right-wing extremist just declared that the Supreme Court is violating the Constitution? No, this is the Utah Supreme Court up here in this big building on top of the hill. They decided that the federal government's court, the highest court of the land, was violating the Constitution, and they used a very strong word. See it right here? What does foisting mean? I just love my Webster Collegiate Dictionary. Foist, to impose by fraud. Ooh. So the Utah Supreme Court just said that the Supreme Court of the United States is imposing by fraud whims upon the American people. Oh, it gets better. There are 15 pages like this. It's good stuff. Here's another sample out of that 15 pages. You're liking it, aren't you? "As a result of the recent holdings of that court, the sovereignty of the states is practically abolished, and the erstwhile free and independent states, the sovereign, independent, free states, in effect and purpose are merely closely supervised units in the federal system. We just became counties." Well, this is really not as accurate as I would like to see it. This word sovereignty right up here, "the sovereignty of the states is practically abolished," that is not correct. The sovereignty of the states was abolished when the freedom to choose the form of government by which you will be ruled is removed from your state. You're no longer sovereign. When they say you cannot choose the form of government, you must have the form of government you now have, you're not sovereign. Forgive me, it's gone then. You've lost it. When did that happen? Well, yeah, Utah wrote it into the Constitution of Utah. They said, we'll never, ever give up our program ever again. It's in the state constitution. I just read it a month ago. It happened in the days of Abraham Lincoln and the Civil War. That's where we lost our sovereignty. You'll have to do your own homework on that. Don't have time to cover it here. There's good reading on the table.
I didn't catch. This is a recent ruling?
Well, 1968. Okay. That's not very recent, but still it's within my lifetime and yours. It's modern people in Salt Lake City. It's not some right-wing kook. That's all I'm trying to say. It isn't some extremist group. It's the Supreme Court speaking. I doubt if we could get them to say it again. Still, we're in Diet versus Turner. Bear with me here. This is valuable. Understand this one. In regard to the 14th Amendment, which the present Supreme Court of the United States has, by decision chosen, as the basis for invading the rights and prerogatives of the once sovereign states, I put once in, it is appropriate to look at the means and methods by which that amendment was foisted, there's that word again, upon the nation in times of emotional stress. Do you mean to say our Supreme Court in Utah said that the 14th Amendment was by fraud and force brought into existence? Yes, that's what they just said. And then they give 5 pages of detail in the Supreme Court case. Oh yes, I was grateful that the attorney in Maryland sent me a copy. It was very, very beneficial to get a better grasp of what's going on. This is the bench. Okay, betrayed by the bench. If we want to name one where they really started to radically deviate, and there were certainly many other examples before this court was in session, but the Warren Court is the one that I would say is the big radical change in American government. It was so bad that somebody put this sign up. I don't know who. I was just thumbing through a history book one day and I saw this picture and I grabbed it and put it on the screen. Save our republic, impeach Earl Warren. Now, Raoul Berger is a very credible legal historian. He, in 1972, he wrote the book Government by Judiciary, The Transformation of the 14th Amendment. And it was very worthwhile reading. If you don't have a lot of reading time, don't read it, but there are others more modern, like the one that we're offering you tonight, Betrayed by the Bench, will get you up to speed faster than this will. But this is excellent reading. And the man is a heuristic historian. He is attempting to tell the truth. And here's what he says. The Warren Court revised the 14th Amendment to mean exactly the opposite of what its framers designed it to mean. That's pretty straightforward, isn't it?
What is the 14th Amendment?
Read it on your own.
Okay.
It was a Civil War amendment that was designed to do good things. He tells in this book, he tells the good things it was designed to do. And then it was abused. And so this modern bench reinvented the 14th Amendment to mean whatever they wanted it to mean. And I'll give you an example of some of the atrocious interpretations that they applied. A hellish interpretation, one author calls it. A hellish interpretation. This is not what the 14th Amendment was designed to do. But here's what they did with it. It became the amendment which they used to justify the evolution of judicial murder. Raw judicial tyranny, one of the chief justices called it. And that was the one that's passed away recently. I'm trying to get his name to flip up. Name all the chief justices for the... Yes, William Rehnquist said, this was raw judicial tyranny when the court came to this 5-4 decision. What was that decision? The decision in Roe versus Wade. The war on the unborn began. No country in the history of the world's ever done such a heinous crime as we're now committing daily. We're doing in as many infants daily as were killed in the 911 crash every day. Are there any headlines about it? Do you see any news? Do you get to see it on evening TV 55 times in one night like they did the towers collapsing? No, just another thing. Just another day has gone by.
Only if you try to stop it.
Oh, okay, then it'll get in the news. Okay, thank you. Criminalizing abortion violates a woman's right to privacy as guaranteed in the Due Process Clause of the 14th Amendment. Well, Where did they find it in the due process clause? Oh, they said, now this is what they used for words, in the penumbras and emanations coming from the 14th Amendment. We don't want to make a discussion or we'll get...
No, I'm just asking, what is the, whatever you said of the amendment?
The 14th Amendment?
No, like
the penumbras?
Yeah.
The penumbras is a word meaning the images around, surrounding it. Out here, kind of like the aura around Mars or Jupiter. Out there in the hazy distance beside the object. That's the penumbra. And the emanations. And those are the two words they use when they describe how they discovered in the Constitution the right to do this. It's hard to believe, isn't it, that thinking people would make those kind of decisions. This picture is not up to date. I can't keep it up to date. Every day another 3,000 die. Each cross represents 25,000 babies murdered since abortion was legalized. I'm told the figure is in excess of 48 million. No country has ever done this to their offspring before. This is the United States. What? How long, going back to this beautiful girl back in Germany, how long will we allow this? How long before we finally say, enough is enough? In kindness and gentleness, it must be. Not in, some people say, let's shoot them, you know, they want to get violent. No, no. Let's just do it legally and lawfully. Let's first get wisely informed and then take a legal and lawful approach to stopping this heinous crime. That's what's going on right now. Justice William Rehnquist said, "This is an improvident and extravagant exercise of the power of judicial review." Now, this Anton Scalia is fun to listen to. He seems to have his head screwed on right, if we use modern language here. Let us read it here. "Nothing stands behind the court's assertion that governmental affirmation of the society's belief in God is unconstitutional except the court's own say-so, citing as support only the unsubstantiated say-so of earlier courts going back no farther than the mid-20th century." He's a great guy. On the table up here, we have a pile of little pamphlets about Thomas Jefferson and the First Amendment. That's what he's speaking about here, is the court's decisions. It's the best thing I've ever seen on it. It comes from the Wall Builders, and if you went to wallbuilders.com in case we're out of brochures, it's excellent reading, and we'll give you the best that I've seen on the First Amendment and this problem that the courts have created. Going back to Judge Bork, "No person should be nominated or confirmed who does not display both a grasp of and devotion to the philosophy of original understanding." That's the position we as constitutionalists should take. No person should be placed on the Supreme Court who does not understand the concept and willing to follow the concept of original understanding, or, in other words, original intent. That takes us back to where we started, Betrayed by the Bench. You'll find it valuable reading. And he says in his book somewhere, "Understanding where we once were and how we have gotten to where we are today can be used to bring America back to again being truly one nation under God." Now that's our next month's lesson. We're going to try and understand where we once were and how we got to where we are. That's next month's lesson, and we'll spend the whole evening on that topic. We call it The Evolution of America from 1620 to 2007. Don't miss it. Okay, we take our seats again, please, and we'll take the second round on a totally different subject. So if you've had enough on the Supreme Court, we're going to talk about money. I welcome your comments, and those of you that want to visit and share your feelings, I welcome them, but I'm not humanly able to hear them all, so please be kind and patient with me and understand that. If you want to write me a letter, I'd be glad to have that. If you want to sign your name, that's even better. You know, I don't want an anonymous letter. Just let me know who you are and what you think, if you don't like it or if you do like it. Pardon?
Do you have an email address?
It's on Liberty and Learning. I do not do email. Okay. It's that my physical address is on Liberty and Learning. Okay, this concept comes in many different forms. And we've heard it all our lives. Somebody undoubtedly must have taught this to you when you were little, something like this, you know. It's really important to learn our history. Or some, you know, I think about the... Every time, Joe Williams, when I try to remember what Ben Franklin said, it always goes blank. I'm going to have to teach you that one so you can prompt me from the crowd. Oh, I remember this. This is the quote that I've learned recently. It's quite short. Ben Franklin is given attributed for having given one similar to that. And we have James Madison saying something similar and other founders. And we've all heard something to the effect that if we don't learn lessons from history, then we are doomed to suffer the same problems of the past. We've all heard things like this. And yet we continue, as a body of people in America, to ignore our history. Where have you ever heard anything like I'm presenting here in these evenings? Where will you hear it? Have I told the truth? Well, for the most part, I think we'll have, you know, I think only a few errors once in a while. But the concepts that we're teaching are the things that are left out of history. And last month we quoted from a book called The Lies My Teacher Told Me, written by a history professor. And he wrote that because of the experience he was having with the new freshman students coming in from the high schools. And you remember that was a book report on 12 high school history books. And he titles it The Lies My Teacher Told Me. And he says these books are guilty of brainwashing, whitewashing, blackout. That's just when you plain leave out things they need to know. And propaganda. And last month's lesson, we gave you examples of each one of those from current modern history books. Now we're going to talk about money. And what you see tonight will be so weird, if you haven't heard it before, that it'll blow your mind as we talk about how money is created. I went into the bank a couple of days ago and I couldn't help, you know, I'm just sitting there thinking about this banking system and I have a hard time not laughing in their face as they're dealing the money out over the counter, these things they call money. Okay, Cicero, great statesman of the past. The sinews of war are infinite money. Now, I just read this morning for my morning study a two-page summary of the proposed budget for this coming year of George W. Bush. And it proposes, I don't remember the exact number, about $250 billion of deficit. That's 200, oh, that doesn't bother us anymore. Now, when I was a boy, we talked about a couple of million dollars of deficit. Now it's $250 billion, and we'll show you tonight how that money is created. Newsflash, or news release, February the 12th, 2007, weekly update from Congressman Ron Paul. Now he has this on his telephone site. You can dial a telephone number, I'll give it to you later in the evening, and you can listen to his weekly update. Good material. The war in Iraq has cost more than $500 billion. In another year or two, the cost will easily top $1 trillion. Paying for war with credit is reckless and stupid, but paying for war by depreciating our currency is criminal. United States Congressman Ron Paul. He is the only member of the House of Representatives or the Senate that pays any attention to his oath to uphold and defend this Constitution, not the one created by the legislature, the executive, and the judicial branch. This old creature here, we bring him in every now and the great deluder, the old deluder, Satan. I just love this piece of artwork. I like to do wood engraving, and this is a wood engraving. Wood engraving is where you take little tiny sharp tools and you gouge out the end grain of hard, hard wood, like hard maple works very good. You gouge it out, you cut little lines, and you create this kind of a picture, or whatever picture you want to illustrate. During the War of 1789 going on in France, the French Revolutionary War, it says in one of the histories that I read of that time period that pornography was being created to pollute even the minds of those who couldn't read. And they do it by this form of art, carving in a block of wood and then printing it in an old wooden printing press. Maybe I'll do it next time. Show you a picture of an old wooden printing press. I build things. I make things, and I'm just finishing, my son and I, two old wooden printing presses, and one of them goes to Independence National Park to print the Constitution by the federal government. We'll deliver that and set it in place in June. Won't that be fun? to be back there and see what they say.
See which constitution they've
kept. Yeah, that's it. Okay, The Empire of Debt is excellent reading. I cannot keep them in stock. I keep buying them in cases and they keep disappearing. If you don't have a copy and you'd like to read it, it goes along excellent. I can't say enough how much enjoyable these authors are fun to read. I think that they put enough humor in it that you don't feel burdened down and want to commit suicide or something, you know. They're just entertaining. I really like the chapter on the best presidents. The best presidents America has ever had. Who is the best president? And then they give you some great ideas from, you know, choosing possibilities. Like one of them, since I am in Millard County and I teach this class in Fillmore. They say, Millard Fillmore was one of the great presidents. What makes him a great president? It's because he didn't do anything. Think about that, they say. No new deals, no raw deals, no deals of any kind. He just stayed in the White House and minded his own business. And then they do give him credit for one thing that he did. He was the president that put the first bathtub in the White House. Okay, so they add a little humor as they go through this very burdensome topic of the Empire of Debt. In 1916, the richest man in the country, John D. Rockefeller, could have paid off the American national debt all by himself. In 1997, William Gates and Warren Buffett together could not pay 2 months' interest on the debt. Now, that was 1997. And ladies and gentlemen, I can assure you that if they couldn't pay it in 1997, they couldn't pay it today. Because since 1997, if you were drawing it on a line graph, it would go like that, skyrocketing. The Creature from Jekyll Island is another one of the books that I would pile them up out here if I had the ability to bring that many books. It's excellent reading.
That's back on the shelf at Barnes & Noble now.
Good. Barnes & Noble has it, he says. Very enjoyable. I've enjoyed the live lectures from the same gentleman, Edward Griffin. And let's see, what did he say in that lecture? He says, I chose this title carefully so that when people saw it on the bookshelf, they might think it's a sequel to Jurassic Park. This book's good for its pictures. I mean, when's the last time you saw $1 million piled on your kitchen table? Yeah, they also include pictures like this. You've heard the old phrase, it's not worth a continental. And what they were doing was creating too much paper money, and it became so that George Washington said, it takes a wagon load of money to buy a wagon load of goods. Alexander Hamilton was one viewpoint. His viewpoint was a national debt, if it is not excessive, will be to us a national blessing. It will be a powerful cement to our nation. Oh, tell me now what happened with that story. Thomas Jefferson didn't share that same opinion. He had a different opinion. He wrote, I believe that banking institutions are more dangerous to our liberties than standing armies. Already they have raised up a money aristocracy that has set the government at defiance. The issuing power should be taken from the banks and restored to the government to whom it properly belongs. That's quite a different viewpoint than Hamilton. Andrew Jackson didn't like the banking system, and on his second run for president, his main platform was, if you elect me president, I will abolish the Bank of the United States. And he won by a landslide, because the people realized that that was not a good procedure. Andrew Jackson abolished it to the best of his ability. However, a few years later, it was reinstituted again, and Salmon P. Chase, Secretary of the Treasury, in 1863, and then he wrote later, said, my agency in promoting the passage of the National Bank Act of 1863 was the greatest financial mistake of my life. It should have been repealed. By the way, I left off Alexander Hamilton's later quote. You know, these people, have you ever seen anybody like that? In their youth, they have these great ideas. And when they get a little older, then they change their mind. Now, thank goodness in some cases. Well, Alexander Hamilton changed his mind, and we quote that in our book, The Making of America. We quote where he's saying his decision for a national bank was a mistake. Salmon Chase also recognized that. There was a young lawyer named Abraham Lincoln in 1838. He was speaking to the Young Men's Lyceum and was an influential force for good at that time. And he wrote, or he spoke, and then it was written, if destruction be our lot, we must ourselves be its author and finisher. As a nation of freemen, we must live through all time or die by suicide. Now, we go to a modern book, 2006, and we did have a stack of them up here. John Denson, it's good reading. It's a good heuristic history as a man tries to gather together the story. He writes, Abraham Lincoln himself became the principal instigator of America's suicide. It was not a foreign foe, but it was a war, even a victorious war, that ended the founder's dream in America. However, leftist intellectuals have never revealed to the American people the real cause and effect of the Civil War, and instead proclaim it a noble war to free the slaves, and therefore worth all the cost. Now this is very much worthwhile to pursue and understand, this bit of our history, and we'll cover that in a little bit more detail next month. Lincoln had acted initially and primarily only to secure the economic and political domination of the North over the South. At the end of the war, he finally seemed to understand the real cost as revealed by this statement. Now we quote Abraham Lincoln again, as he's an older president now. As a result of the war, corporations have been enthroned, and an era of corruption in high places will follow. And the money power of the country will endeavor to prolong its reign by working upon the prejudices of the people until wealth is aggregated in the hands of a few and the republic is destroyed. Now he's predicting that if the money powers take control, the republic will be destroyed. That's his observation shortly before he was assassinated. By 1907, using the same phrase that he chose to use, the money power of the country understood that to accomplish its ultimate objective, it must have a privately controlled bank of issue, which would regulate credit and the money supply, a huge public debt on which to base its currency, and an unrestricted income tax to pay the interest on that debt. Now, the money powers needed this to happen to accomplish more money power. Who said this? Think of all the great people of the past and good sayings. The abandonment of the gold standard made it possible for the welfare statist to use the banking system as a means to an unlimited expansion of credit. In the absence of the gold standard, there is no way to protect savings from confiscation through inflation. The same person said this. And the financial policy of the welfare state requires that there be no way for the owners of wealth to protect themselves. These three statements were given in 1966 by Alan Greenspan, who later became the chairman of the Federal Reserve Board and renounced all three concepts. We're going to cover a few points from this book. They give reasons why the Federal Reserve System should be abolished. There are seven reasons that Edward Griffin lists. The Federal Reserve is incapable of accomplishing its stated objects, and we'll name those objects this evening. It is a cartel operating against the public interest. It is the supreme instrument of usury. It generates the most unfair tax. It encourages war. It destabilizes the economy. And it is an instrument of totalitarianism. Now, if any one of those was true, that's reason enough to abolish the Fed. We'll only cover two or three of them now. They're all true, but we'll just try to give you an introduction about three of them. The Republican whip in the Senate, Nelson Aldrich, very prominent man. Beware of what? The flattery of the smooth talk. The smooth talk of prominent man. He was a smooth talker and a prominent man. He was the chairman of the National Monetary Commission in the Senate, and they gave him this assignment. Break the grip of the money trust. Now, it seems that in New York City, there were a lot of wealthy financiers who were called the money trust. And they had the grip on America. You know, they were controlling the money system. And so his assignment as the chairman of the National Monetary Commission was to stop that. So what did he do? We'll find out in just a moment. Abraham Piot Andrew was the Assistant Secretary of Treasury. He later became a congressman and was prominent in banking circles. Another prominent man. Frank Vanderlip, president of the National City Bank of New York, represented William Rockefeller. He also represented Kuhn Loeb and Company, some of the wealthiest companies in the world. Henry Davison, senior partner in J.P. Morgan Company. Charles Norton, president of the First National Bank of New York. And head of J.P. Morgan's Bankers Trust Company, Benjamin Strong, became the first head of the Federal Reserve System 3 years later. Not least, Paul Warburg, a partner in the Kuhn Loeb and Company representing the Rothschilds and Warburgs in Europe. Now, these men that I just showed you controlled about 25% of the entire wealth of the entire world. They had their fingers in everybody's pocketbook through some procedure. They were the money trust. And who was with them? The chairman of the Senate committee. He was one of them. They all got together. Now, this is a very unique picture. You can see this picture in the Creature to Jekyll Island. This is a picture of a secret combination. These people gathered together in secret. You can read the story in detail in there. And in complete total secrecy, they went to an island off the coast of Georgia that still exists. In fact, this is the photograph that Mr. Griffin puts in to represent where they went, to J.P. Morgan's private hunting club. And Griffin points out that this is no common building. Remember, this is in the year 1910. How many of your parents or your great-grandparents or whoever family member, how many of you can remember what kind of indoor plumbing you had in 1910? You think about it? Yeah, I can remember when I was a boy we still had an outhouse. My generation and my folks, that was quite, everybody had an outhouse. Nobody had a bathroom. Well, in 1910, there were 14 bathrooms. If that tells you something about the wealth of these people, and this they called their winter cabin. Okay, this is where they went to play games in the winter, and then in the summer they went back to their regular residence. You're starting to get these are the money trust. These are the people controlling 25% of the world's money. Frank Vanderlip wrote, and by the way, people say, could this be true? Where does this come from? This is some, again, we're getting some right-wing extremist making this up. Aristic history. Well, they wrote it themselves. After many, many, many years had gone by, when they felt that the system that they had established was completely in place, then they wanted to say, we did this. We take credit for establishing the greatest banking system the world has ever known. And that's just the words that were used when I went into a bank one time to encourage the banker to come to class. And he said, Mr. Pratt, this is the greatest banking system the world has ever known. The one I'm about to show you. Frank Vanderlip's statement says that they went in secret and they performed their duties in secret, and now he's telling the world about them because it's such a wonderful thing they accomplished. Let's take a look at Fed is not federal. As a researcher many years ago, once in a while you come across these little nuggets, and I'm reading a newspaper, San Francisco Chronicle or B or something like that. And in this newspaper, and I'm quoting myself, by the way, this little thing here is a publication I wrote several years ago. Ferns. Anybody know what ferns are? Federal Reserve notes, okay. But in that paper it said, some people still think we're a branch of the government. We're not. We're the bank's bank. And then it was an advertisement for employees. You can come to work for us and you'll be working for a private bank. Just as clear as that. We're not part of the federal government. Well, I thought that was pretty clear. What is the Fed if it's not part of the federal government? It is an association of private banks operating in partnership with the federal government. It's a private-public partnership. Now, this artwork is from my son, who's now 33 years old with three children. And he was at the lecture last week when I showed this. I did not tell the audience that he was in the audience. Would you please rise? When he was about 4 years old, I gave him a crayon and said, son, I want you to draw a picture of a goldsmith standing in front of his safe. Because this is the story that you read when you go to the Federal Reserve Bank and you take their literature out of their boxes out in the lobby to show their history. This is the story. Many, many years ago in Europe, there were goldsmiths who had safe depository boxes, and people who had gold and didn't have a safe box, they would take it to the goldsmith for safe storage. And they would give it to the goldsmith, and he would give them a receipt called the gold receipt, showing that you had deposited in his safe deposit box, or his safe, your gold. Now, after years went by, the goldsmiths, and there were many of them, having this kind of a business, kind of like I was a young man once, and I raised beans, and I took them to a bean warehouse and stored the beans there, and I got a bean receipt. Well, in this case, you'd get a gold receipt. Well, the people were exchanging the gold receipts as if they were as good as gold. And they would say, you know, simply, down at local goldsmith, you can get it if you want. And they would take the receipt instead of going down to get the gold to exchange. Very convenient. And the goldsmiths, this is all in the Federal Reserve literature. It's where you read this. And the goldsmiths discovered, and they don't even hint this is dishonest, not even the slightest hint. The goldsmiths discovered that only a few people ever came back to get their gold. In fact, only about 10% of them ever came back. And so what they discovered was they could write out 9 times as many receipts as they had gold. Oh, never a hint that it's dishonest. And they say in the literature, this became the foundation for today's fractional reserve banking. Okay, try the next one. Now, this artwork is from their literature. This is one of the, you know, very wealthy financial organizations of the world, probably the biggest con artist the world has ever known, and they can't even hire a competent artist. This is their artwork in their literature, showing the pyramid scheme of how they've constructed the system. How did they choose the name? Is there anything federal about it? Not a thing. They picked the name federal because it gives you a feeling of comfort and confidence in the system. It's part of our government. It's federal. How about the next word? Is there any reserve anywhere? Do they have a vault with anything in it? No. No, they really don't. But this feeling of confidence is once again secured. Now, how about the last word? People in that time period, 1910, were really concerned about the money trust. And so they kept saying, we've got to break the grip of the money trust. This powerful group of bankers in New York is running the country. And so they said, we've got to put the image out of a system. A system. And so they built banks in different parts of the country. And then you could go with your wife to the bank in, say, San Francisco, and you could stand out in front of the bank, this big, beautiful new building, Federal Reserve Bank of San Francisco. And you could say, look, Maud, they've broken the grip of the money trust. Look at that. We have our own bank here now. And so the system was an important part of the words. This, again, is their own artwork and their own story from their own literature. I'm just summarizing what I read from going to the bank and pulling out their brochures. The monetary policy is adjusted by a board of governors and so forth. Their artwork wasn't even colored. I had to add the green. Now let's skip back to our founding fathers for just a moment. Every dollar of a bank bill that is issued beyond the quantity of gold and silver in the vaults represents nothing and is therefore a cheat upon somebody. That's pretty old-fashioned thinking nowadays. Okay, do we have anything in the vaults representing anything that's in your wallet? No. No, and we'll show that story in brief summary here. Oh, I like this slide. I like to teach. This is a visual aid of great, great value. Okay, you ready? Congress needs money. Okay, they always need money. Lots of money. They're going to need $250 billion extra beyond what they collect in taxes this year. That's a lot of money. So what do they do? Well, Congress goes to the Treasury and they say, we need money. Oh, the Treasury says, we're sorry. You spent everything we collected in taxes by February 15th. Oh, well, that's not a problem. No problem, they say. So then they go down to the government printing office and they say, we would like you to print, we need money, and we'd like you to print some IOUs. And so they print what's called the United States Treasury Bond. And they put whatever number on there Congress tells them to put on. We need $1 billion. Today that isn't very much. It should probably be a trillion on my example here. But $1 billion is what Edward Griffin used. We need $1 billion. And so they get this piece of paper now that's printed, and it says $1 billion. I'm a printer, by the way. I just love old-fashioned printing. And next month I'll be down in Texas teaching old-fashioned printing to a book history class. I do it every year. It's quite enjoyable. Any takers want to come do book history with me? People from all over the United States come to Texas A&M University to study book history, how we print old-fashioned things. And what I'm giving you here is a simplified illustration. Obviously, today we would have computer entries and things, electronic. But in the old days, a piece of paper was printed, a United States bond, and what, you know, it's an IOU. That's all it is. The government gives this to someone, the public, and they say, you know, will you buy this bond? Some of us do. So we buy the bond, and we're promised that after a period of time, we'll get an increase on our investment. Well, the public doesn't buy all the bonds. They still have lots of bonds they need to get rid of. That's where the Federal Reserve System comes in. So we go then, the Congress does, to the Fed. This is their function. And they say, we need money. We're desperate. We've got this new social program that's going to take $1 billion. Oh, good. Now, figuratively speaking, they open a great big drawer. It has to be a big drawer because they've got a lot of bonds in the drawer. They open this great big drawer and they take out a big checkbook. It has to be a big checkbook because they're going to write big numbers on it. And they write a check for $1 billion and they give it to Congress. And Congress gives them the IOU and they put it in the drawer. Now, where's the backing for this check that Congress just received? Is there some reserve somewhere? No, it's just a piece of paper. They just exchanged one piece of paper for the other piece of paper. Well, that's not the end of the story. If that seems really hard to understand, don't try to understand it because it'll blow your mind. It's not possible to understand that kind of banking. Well, what do they do with the check? Well, they take it to the Congress, you know, takes it to the Treasury, and they give it to the Treasury, and what's the Treasury do with it? Oh, well, they deposit it in the Federal Reserve Bank. Don't try to understand this. This is an accurate summary of what they do. There may be a few little jiggles and wiggles, you know, that I haven't itemized here, but this is what they do. They deposit it in the Federal Reserve Bank, usually the Bank of New York, break the grip of the money trust, usually the Bank of New York, and then what does Congress do? Well, then they start writing checks. Well, they pay, you know, all sorts of things. They write checks. They send $100 million to some foreign dictator. Like we were sending to Saddam Hussein not many years ago, okay? Supporting Saddam Hussein with our money and on our machines. They pay the bill at the United Nations. They funnel another $100 million to the International Monetary Fund. They buy some votes with benefits of some kind. They invade a foreign country. Whatever is in the national interest. Where did this money come from? They created it out of nothing. Absolutely nothing. But that's not the end of the story. It gets better, if you can imagine that. It gets more bizarre, is what I should say. More bizarre. This is again from the Federal Reserve literature right out of their bank, out in the front lobby of the bank. The multiplying capacity of reserve money. So the Fed sets up a procedure to determine how much money you can multiply. How big this factor can be, and tonight we're going to use the example that's marked in yellow, as we're going to use the factor of 10. So we're going to multiply the money by 10, and here's how that works. Let's go back for a moment now. We've created $1 billion out of nothing, and we'll trace $100. We'll just trace 100 of that through the system to see what happens to it. The federal government then sends a check to this man right here. Now, he's an employee at the post office. Do you know how I can tell he works at the post office? It's on his tie clip. Okay, he's an employee at the post office, and he gets $100, a $100 check. Now, he's the guy that delivers your mail, or any other number of him, you know, federal employees. So, we're going to trace this guy and his $100. He takes his $100, and he goes to the Happy Valley Bank, and he deposits his check. I would like to deposit $100. Well, I just did this yesterday, you know, deposited my money at the bank. And that's when I was smiling. One time I said to the banker, "You're one of those fractional reserve banks, aren't you?" And you know what the answer was I got back from the banker? A laugh. That was the answer. "You're one of those fractional reserve banks, aren't you?" Okay. He deposits $100. Now what happens to that $100? "Oh, well, there's another window in the bank. Just step around here, sir." This is a man that wants to borrow money from the bank. The Happy Valley Loan Department. Well, here the banker standing behind the counter. How much money is he going to be able to loan now that $100 has been deposited? Well, we all know it's $900, don't we? Common sense tells us that. $100 deposited, now we can loan $900. Remember, it's a fractional reserve bank, and it's a ratio of 10 to 1. We have to keep one part in reserve, and nine parts we loan out. But the one part in reserve, where did it come from? It came out of the air. Was there any backing for it? No. But now we've just amplified it into $900 with no backing and no value whatever. This is not oversimplified. This is how it works. For every dollar that is created out of nothing for the federal government, $9 are created out of nothing for the commercial banking system. A private-public partnership created by the Money Trust in 1910 in a country clubhouse with 14 bathrooms on Jekyll Island. Check me out on the bathrooms. I'm not sure that's right, but something like that. The Fed, this is another one of the points we want to make, is the supreme instrument of usury. What is usury?
Interest.
Interest. And in the old days in biblical history, we considered it any interest, but in modern times, they talk about excessive interest. Now, let's just look at this application, the concept of usury here. Let's say that you wanted to borrow some money to buy a home. And I give this example with a $100,000 home, and people laugh and say, "Where can you buy a home for $100,000? I don't know what they're going for nowadays, but that was apparently not a large enough figure. If you're paying 6% interest, which is when I checked with the bank, that's what the current interest were available, interest on a 30-year loan, you're going to pay $115,924 in interest, plus you have to repay the loan. Now, where did they get that money? Yeah, they got it out of thin air by a deposit that they magnified 9 times, and now they loan it out at interest. And there's a whole other story of how the interest is created. They loaned it out at interest, and now they collect back more than what they loaned you. I would call that usury. I think that's a correct application of that term. Collecting interest on money which was created out of thin air. Newsflash. Somebody told me a month ago, don't say things that are scary at your meetings. Don't say anything scary. The American people appear to be oblivious to the economic hurricane which is expected to touch down in late 2007. That's when $1 trillion in adjustable rate mortgages will reset, triggering a massive increase in foreclosures and plunging the country into a deep recession. This is one man's opinion. It may not happen. Go to his website, read the rest of it. Our banker was handing these out in Fillmore, Utah, handing out the pages off this man's website when one of our students took it to him in the bank and invited him to come to this lecture. He didn't come, but he copied it, and the next lecture, when we get it, people came and said, "Look what my banker gave me." I found that very interesting, very interesting. We did have a banker attend one evening. He sat on the front row. I'm going to look around now and see if we can see any distinguished gentlemen here tonight. Oh, you pathetic bunch of guys. Oh, right here, John. John is distinguished. He has his necktie on, looks like a gentleman. Right on the front row, I was lecturing in Logan, Utah, and this man was taking notes like mad and seemed to be interested and good eye contact. And when the evening was over, he got up along with the others and he left it. But as he left, he dropped a note off at the front door by one of our visitor attendants. And they came up with a funny grin on their face and handed it to me. And he had written, "I'm sorry I had to leave early," meaning he couldn't stay to visit. He says, "I believe and agree with everything you said. even though I am the president of the First Security Bank of Smithfield, Utah. That was fun. The housing bubble, this is a worthwhile magazine, by the way, the Freeman, put out by the Foundation for Economic Education, another one of these excellent sites in the web and printed literature. They depict the housing bubble, the one that we just read about, possibly bursting at the end of 2007. Now, back to the goals of the Federal Reserve System. This, again, is their literature created by their artist for their banking system to show what they're, why they're such a good way to go. So, on this side, we see the reasons if we don't have the Fed, we will have unregulated growth, inflated prices. Without the Fed, we will have inflated prices, and we will have unemployment. Remember, they started in 1913. And in 1913 until 2007, we've never experienced unregulated growth, inflated prices, or unemployment, have we? What have we experienced? Well, we've experienced this since they formed their organization. Regulated growth, stable prices, and people working. They still hand this out. This is still what they say the function of the Fed is. Unkept Fed promises. Many years ago in Salt Lake City, I was a part of a research and study group called the Freeman Institute. And then they changed their name to the National Center for Constitutional Studies. And I was honored to be there. I spent 7 years full-time in their employ. At that time, we did research, and here's some of the research that we published. The unkept promises. Interest rates will always be low. Now, these were promises when they were trying to get the Federal Reserve Act passed. Congress was told, pass this bill and interest rates will always be low. Financial panics will be impossible. That was in 1913 when they declared that. The Fed will destroy the powerful money trust on Wall Street. Do you know what a prevaricator is? America will have permanent prosperity. The Federal Reserve Board will prevent depressions. All Federal Reserve notes can ultimately be redeemed in gold. But this one here is the best one of all. The Fed automatically prevents inflation. Now, do you know what the 50X means? That means we found that 50 times. 50 times they promised the Congress that if you'll pass the Federal Reserve Act, there won't be any inflation. The Fed generates the most unfair tax. What is the most unfair tax? Inflation. We'll go into it as we look at the pictures here. Let's suppose that when I was a little boy, I dropped a dollar in my bank. This is my grandson. He posed for me. And my parents told me that if I put money in my piggy bank and I could open it later for something important like going to college. Did you ever hear anything like that? And so you had savings. If I put the money in the bank when I was a little boy and got it out now, it wouldn't be worth 10 cents. They robbed my piggy bank without ever opening it. This is an accurate graph showing what happened. Here I am right here as a little boy. And here I am today, right down here. And that's what happened to my money. It went from a dollar down to less than... One man the other night said it's about 4 cents from when I started where I am now. Salt Lake Tribune, February the 7th, 1980. Lawrence Roos, president of the Federal Reserve Bank of St. Louis, said, Roos believes that the main cause of inflation is the creation of too much money by the Federal Reserve Board. Quote, most people think inflation is caused by greedy businessmen or powerful unions. Roos says to tell them it is caused by too much money under Federal Reserve policies produces puzzled stares. This is what inflation is. It's too much money produced by the Federal Reserve System. John Maynard Keynes was a famous English economist. He was so famous that the American economist followed him, believed him. He was world-renowned. One of his strategies that he explained was, and I paraphrased a longer quote, by a planned program of inflation, we can confiscate the wealth of the people, and not one man in a million will be able to diagnose what is happening. I Who knows? If you go out on the street and stop the passerby and say, tell me about inflation, oh, it's those greedy capitalists. It's those greedy businessmen that are causing that. Or it's, and they'll have anything but the real cause. The Federal Reserve System is the cause of inflation by creating too much money. Oops, we missed one. Let's try this political caricature of 1919. This is actually from that time period, from a newspaper then. Who's the center focus of attention here? Karl Marx. Who's clustered around him? The money trust. So here we have all these guys that are the wealthy men of the world clustering around the doctrines of Marxism. Now, I really came across the jewel here. As a researcher, sometimes you just come across real nuggets. You're in some musty corner of the library where nobody ever goes. You have to almost blow the dust off the book. Not quite that bad, but it's pretty, you know, just unused. And I'm thumbing through these ancient books looking for some nuggets. Just looking, see what I can learn. And I come across this one, named The Failure of the Federal Reserve, the North American Review, that's the magazine, May 1929, H. Parker Willis. Now, it's always fun to know who people are. Now, it's important to know I am a blacksmith. Isn't that important? And I'm lecturing on American history. Is that important? Well, would it help you to know that I can do other things besides blacksmithing? I'm quite good at woodworking also. Gaining confidence in me now? Okay, this man had some real credentials. Here's who he was. He was the expert advisor to President Wilson on the Fed. He wrote the Central Banking Bill of 1912. He was the associate editor of the New York Journal of Commerce. He was a professor of economics at Washington Lee University. He was appointed as the first secretary of the Federal Reserve Board. Now, when this man speaks, do you think he has some degree of understanding about the Federal Reserve System? He resigned from his position with the Federal Reserve Board to declare in May of 1929, and notice the month, this is important, in May of 1929, he announced the Federal Reserve is a failure. Well, if he thought it was a failure in May, what did he think in October? Now, Hans Senholtz is an economist who I respect. He wrote, "The simple truth is that without the Federal Reserve System, there can be no continuing march toward socialism, and with it there can be no free economy. That is why the adherents of liberty and capitalism cannot rest until the Federal Reserve System is abolished." Good free market economist from the Foundation for Economic Education. Now, we've been slowly disciplined in the use of paper money, which was originally a warehouse receipt showing that we had on deposit silver, gold, called specie, or other commodities. We've been conditioned. Here's an example of this. These bills all look the same, don't they? They all looked the same to me for a long time until I read the fine print. I read it because some author, some writer, called my attention to it. On this first one, this is the fine print. This certifies that there have been deposited in the Treasury of the United States of America $10 in gold coin payable to the bearer on demand. Well, that's called a warehouse receipt. It's a real, legitimate warehouse receipt. If you take that certificate to the United States Treasury, they're bound to give you $10 worth of gold. Now, we won't talk about the manipulation of the gold price, but that's a gold certificate. Then, the next one over, the United States of America will pay to the bearer on demand $10, redeemable in gold on demand at the United States Treasury. Remember, the Fed promised that their notes would be redeemable in gold. Well, the first ones were. And this is part of the history of the Fed. As it progresses along, they change the rules. It's been amended more than 100 times. But once it passed, there was no more debate that anybody paid any attention to. They just kept amending it. And pretty soon we had no gold backing. This receipt, or this certificate, this certifies that there is on deposit in the Treasury of the United States of America $10 in silver payable to the bearer on demand. Is this still a warehouse receipt? It is. The United States of America will pay to the bearer on demand $10, period. Redeemable in lawful money at the United States Treasury. Now watch this sleight of hand here. As a printer, I really like this. Oops, I went too far. Back that one off. This promise right here says the same exact thing that promise says. It's just half the type size, half the point size. You know, in computers, you can call up the point size. Well, in the old days, it was lead type. And you'd pull lead type out of the drawer, and you'd set it. Anyway, that's it. That's all they did. They just changed it so you couldn't see it without a magnifying glass. And then what did they do on the next one? There isn't any promise at all. And that's what you carry in your wallet today. That's a brief summary of our money from 1928 to 2007. Now, some people have never seen a silver certificate. These young men right over here, this is probably the only time they'll see one. A silver certificate. That bill up at the top says silver certificate. Can you see it right up there on the top? Silver certificate. What's this one say? Federal Reserve note. Well, that's long since gone. No more warehouse receipts. Interest-free currency since 1878. When I was a researcher 25 years ago, I found this in the federal law books, and I copied it, thought it was interesting. They showed that they were still allowing $300 million in United States notes to be printed. And actually, that discontinued. It's not supposed to be there, but it is. The top one, notice at the top what it says right up here? Yeah, United States note right up there. This one down here is a Federal Reserve note. In Money Masters, it said that they discontinued the United States notes in 1994. I only saw it once, and I think I picked that up accurately, but that's what I saw there. And so there's no more United States note after 1994. Well, what's the significance? The United States note is no interest created by the federal government. There's nobody to pay, no private banks involved. Down here, we pay interest on this note to the private banking system. And this year's interest is, I just read it this morning, billions upon billions upon billions of dollars. Interest we pay for using this private bank's money created out of nothing. Harry Dexter White and John Maynard Keynes, both involved heavily in creating the banking and money system for the United States and for the United Nations. The FBI pointed out to President Harry Truman that Harry Dexter White was a communist working inside the high offices of our government. And so Harry Truman advanced him to a high position as president of one of the United Nations banks. I believe it was the International Monetary Fund. President, top leader, big dog, and increased his salary. He was a communist, and John Maynard Keynes was a devout, dedicated socialist. But one of my dear friends that I love, an old lawyer, he wrote, "Communism and socialism are the same thing, just arrived at by different means." Just two names for the same thing. So when there was a socialist revolution, we'll get that next month. We won't quote that tonight. I spill the beans. The national debt doesn't really matter. You ever heard anybody talk like that? You just owe it to yourself. I used to believe that. I used to hear that talk and think, oh, well, that's great. Man, I'm glad we're spending lots of money because it doesn't matter. Well, newsflash, October the 16th, 2006. Congressman Jim Cooper, a Tennessee Democrat, warned that the mammoth $8.5 trillion national debt would actually be $46 trillion if the promises made to workers for the Social Security and Medicare programs were included. Oh, it's a good thing it doesn't matter, isn't it? Good thing it doesn't make any difference. Why should we? Well, he said we should spend ourselves into prosperity. Some of you look baffled, like you don't understand this reasoning. These are the kind of financiers running the United States government today. Newsflash, at the present rate of spending by our conservative Republican administration, oh, I've got to say this, I was speaking at the Lincoln Day celebration just a year ago, and just before I was called up to speak, Senator Orrin Hatch gave a talk, and he said, "You should be thankful that we have a great conservative Republican leading this nation." That was the exact quote. This conservative Republican administration, by the end of the 21st century, our national debt will increase to $9 quadrillion. Even if the U.S. population triples, about $10 million per person. Huh? Debt doesn't matter? Apparently not. He said so. This is a quote you've heard. That's an exact verbatim quote from the Vice President of the United States. Deficits don't matter. Now, I hope you sense by now that that's not true. I hope you understand that deficits do matter, and that matters of public affairs ought to be controlled and contained as matters private ought to be. Newsflash! December the 15th, 2006, report issued from the Treasury Department and the Office of Management and Budget. Now, this is just a summary. You can read the whole story in the New American. The United States is insolvent, is the summary. And there is no way for the nation's bills to be paid with current levels of taxation and promised benefits, period. That's the summary. Did anybody pay any attention to that? Was that headline news? No. No. Almost obscure. Who's this man? He's the only congressman in Washington, D.C. that pays any attention to his promise to uphold this Constitution. His voting record's not as good as Ron Paul's, but you're right, he does some good things. There's some other that do some good things too. How long, he says, how long this financial charade can go on is difficult to judge, but when the end comes, it will not go unnoticed by any American. Call weekly. Write it down if you don't use it already. It's a good, quick way to get an update on what's going on. Ron Paul gives a 3-minute telephone message of some current event happening right now back in Washington, D.C. So there's a way to keep current. I have a hard time keeping up with all the ways to keep current. 888-322-1414. Now, we're going to shift gears back. Let's stand, though, for 1 minute. I'm going to shift gears, but I want you to be awake on this one. Stand and stretch. Now, we only get 3 chances with you, and then I'll never see you again. So I'm going to try and give this shifting gear problem here. That feels so good. I can't believe how patient some of you are. Just sit there with smiles on your face and look intelligent. Okay, well, you can just stay standing for a minute if you want. It's up to you. The gears here. Okay, we're going to go back to 1945. And we're going to introduce you to another character. You all remember something coming up on April the 17th this year. What's coming on April 17th? Tax day. Yeah, that's tax day. But guess what? A very nice procedure has happened to you all through the year. What have you been doing all year long? You've been paying as you go. The pay-as-you-go plan. It was called the pay-as-you-go plan. It was called the Rummel pay-as-you-go plan. Beardsley Rummel created it. And you've been blessed by it. This is the man we're speaking about now. Beardsley Rummel created the pay-as-you-go plan, giving you the blessing of distributing your wealth all year long to the federal government. In 1945, he gave this talk, and then in 1946, it was published, and the title is Taxes for Revenue Are Obsolete. Well, that's a kind of a bizarre title. We all know that we collect taxes for revenue. Isn't that why we tax? So we can pay the bills of government? Well, he has a lot to say about that, and I'll give you a brief summary of it. First of all, who is this man, and why would we listen to him? He was the assistant to the president of the Carnegie Corporation. He was the director of the Laura Spelman Rockefeller Memorial. He was the dean of social science at University of Chicago. But most of all, he was the director of the New York Federal Reserve Bank, the center of the money trust. Now, when he speaks about money, should we listen? Is he credible? I hope so. Here's what he had to say. The necessity for a government to tax in order to maintain both its independence and its solvency is true for state and local governments, but it is not true for a national government. Huh? The state of Utah has to balance their budget. The city of Salt Lake has to balance their budget. The county has to balance its budget. Does the federal government have to balance its budget? Oh, no, he says. No, that's not necessary for national government. 2 changes of the greatest consequence have occurred in the last 25 years, which have substantially altered the position of the national state with respect to the financing of its current requirements. What do you suppose these 2 changes are? The first of these changes is the gaining of vast new experiences in the management of central banks. Now notice what year it is. It's 1946. Franklin Delano Roosevelt did away with the gold standard. We have no gold standard. We've been practicing now since 1913 how to manage our new central bank, creating money out of nothing through fractional banking. So he says, we've had this wonderful thing take place. We now have the experience. We have this central bank. And secondly, the second change is the elimination for domestic purposes of the convertibility of the currency into gold. Oh, isn't this wonderful? Now we can go ahead and create this new system of banking. This is what he's all about. Oh, this is great stuff. Pages and pages of good reading. What are taxes for? If taxes are not for revenue purposes to pay the needs of the national government, what are they for? Why do we even need them? Can't you just go down and create another big piece of paper with $1 billion on it and have them keep sending money to pay the bills? That's what they did in Germany just before Hitler. Remember that system under the Weimar Republic? What did they do? Every day someone reported to the German parliament, whatever the Bundes, whatever they named themselves, they reported daily the amount of bills they'd printed the previous day. Wonderful program. Only one problem. The same thing happened to them as happened to the founding fathers when they created too many continental dollars. Pretty soon a bushel basket of marks wouldn't buy a loaf of bread. What had they failed to do? They had failed in this one thing. I'm going to snap that right on the screen here. This is the key instrument why the government taxes today. It is an instrument of fiscal policy to help stabilize the purchasing power of the dollar. They have to soak in as many paper dollars as they can, withdraw them from circulation to keep inflation from going bizarre. They have to soak back as many as possible. But then what about the ones that go to foreign lands? That's wonderful, as long as they stay there. If they don't come back, then that is an advantage, and that helps to stabilize the dollar. But if the foreigners decided to bring their notes back, spend them in America, then we're in big trouble again with inflation. The Weimar Republic only lasted a couple of years, and then Hitler came in, and that system collapsed, and Hitler took over. Oh, what a relief. Empire of Debt. I don't have time to read it. It's wonderful reading. Another wonderful reading. You can buy anything in the world for money. I will buy up armies and navies, SUVs and flat-screen TVs. Two of my favorite tools to destroy both individuals and nations, debt and war. J. Reuben Clark warned us about the United Nations many, many years ago, even before it was finalized, and then shortly thereafter he had several warnings. He says, if we have the United Nations, we will be in a continuous state of war. And that has been true. Some kind of conflict around the world ever since. Two of my favorite tools to destroy individuals and nations, the old deluder, has deluded enough teachers and leaders and prominent men that the false educational ideas that we have presented this evening have become popularized, and we must take control of our money system or we will be destroyed. Now, that's the end of the heavy stuff. This is the part you're supposed to relax and enjoy. America or Americans are the most generous people in the world, giving $260 billion annually to charity. That's a fact I just read just recently. $260 billion annually, gifts given by people like you. Volunteers in America. This shows an example of some volunteers that work for an organized effort, and they ship out more than 7 million shoebox gifts worldwide every year. Giving. Now, we've been talking about the evils of money. Now we're looking at the good use of money. These are the things that should make your heart warm. Here's a soup kitchen. Free meals for the homeless. Free donated labor by the people issuing the meals. All of this given for free. America is the greatest giving country in the world. Here's a hospital that's not far from here. You can see on the top who it is. The Shriners Hospital for Children. You can see the word behind the young lady in the middle. What's that word say? philanthropic society behind them. What's a philanthropic society? Okay, they're giving. They're giving. The people that created this hospital, it's all funded by voluntary donations. This is a very special picture for me because that's my son and my daughter-in-law and their little boy just 2 months ago as they entered the hospital for the second bone surgery on his two lame legs. Just last week, they went and got the one cast removed as they try to figure out how to fuse a defective leg. It was a leg that was born with a gap in the bones. These wonderful people are so kind and so good at that hospital, I can't express how warm and fun, wonderful I feel when I hear what they're doing there. All from donations. My son said that those plaques on the wall back there each represent $5 million of donated funds going into the hospital. They have apparently many hospitals like this scattered all across the country, I believe in some foreign lands, as a single example of giving. People who love others enough to share of their wealth. Well, this is little Luke after he got out 4 days later, 4 days after the bone surgery, and I can assure you he's faking a smile here. They had about five or six pictures where they said, "Smile, son," because he's still in pain and under drugs. He's 6 weeks, seven, 8 weeks it's been since this happened. 8 weeks have passed, and he's doing much better now. The willingness to give. American individuals donated $2 billion to the tsunami relief. We have no vested interest in the people over there. Why did our people volunteer $2 billion to the tsunami relief? It's because we have people in America who still have a heart of kindness and generosity. What's the greatest gift of all? As I sat eating my snack tonight called supper at the Subway sandwich station, I was looking at the local newspaper, the religion section, and they were summarizing where the Easter services will be held tomorrow all around Salt Lake. They had numerous things to say about Easter. And I thought about the greatest gift of all. Many years ago as a researcher in Salt Lake City, I read the Moscow News. And the Moscow News was a newspaper created by the Soviets to promote their propaganda. And I remember one particular newspaper said, the greatest event ever to take place in the history of the world was the Socialist Revolution of 1917. I read that in a newspaper. They wanted me to believe that. What was the greatest event ever to take place in the history of the world? Christians are going to celebrate it tomorrow. And in closing tonight, I want to mention what influence that had on a group of people, even many who were not Christians. This is the year 1914. It's December of 1914. This map is from the book I just showed, that 2001 publication called Silent Night. It's the story of the World War I truce, published in 2001. So it's a reasonably recent creation. I thoroughly enjoyed reading the book. This map shows about a 300-mile line, the black line, they called No Man's Land. It's the space between the two trenches, barbed wire and trenches, made up the terrain. This is what it looks like from an actual photograph. That's the front cover of the book that we've been promoting up here from about the wars, A Century of War. My son, who is a firefighter, looked at that book and he says, "What happened to this forest?" That's a forest that's been shot away by battle. It's December. It's in France and Belgium that this is taking place. 300 miles of trenches. The weather is bitter cold. Sometimes it's frozen. Sometimes it's just icy mud. Some of the mud, it points out, is so deep that on two occasions they make reference to an individual walking along. He steps into it and disappears. And they don't find him again. Too thick to swim. Can't fish them out? I don't know. Anyway, I mentioned that in the Silent Night book. Here's an artist's conception of life in the trenches as we see the suffering and the misery and the horror of this whole situation. You can see up on the right-hand side of the picture, the right-hand side of the picture, we have the no man's land up here, and the other trenches are over here. So here we are hiding behind this barricade of filth and mud. Well, it's described in the next one here. Otto Dix, a German, described it in writing in these words. Lice, rats, barbed wire, fleas, shells, bombs, underground caves, corpses, blood, liquor, mice, cats, artillery, filth, bullets, mortars, fire, steel. That's what war is. It's the work of the devil. Here's a picture of the trenches, artist's conception. So we have this trench here, and not far away, in fact, it says in the reading that sometimes the trenches were only 80 yards apart. Now you can almost throw a rock that far. You can hear the people talking. And so they're down out of sight over in their trench over here, and you're down out of sight. This is the Allied trenches on this side. This is the barbed wire. And they'd been fighting so long that hundreds of thousands had already died. You couldn't go out in no man's land or you get shot and killed, so they hadn't even cared for the dead or the wounded for 2 months. The bodies are still laying unattended. Now, on December the 24th, 1914, something very unusual began to happen. It didn't happen everywhere. 300 miles of trenches, but it happened in many locations. It wasn't a single isolated thing that took place. It was a miracle that took place in many spots along the trenches, and this is how it started. The Allied forces looked across the no man's land, and they saw lighted Christmas trees being placed up on the bank in front of the German soldiers. And as the lighted Christmas trees came up, they were absolutely wonderment. What is going on here? And then even something stranger, more strange, happened. They began to see signs coming up out of the German trenches. You no shoot, we no shoot. Happy Christmas. And other signs along the way, and then the most phenomenal thing of all, the Germans started coming out of the trenches with no arms, no guns. You no shoot, we no shoot. Unbelievable. What caused this? See, I think I missed one slide in there, that one right there. What caused them to be able to do this? Stille Nacht, Heilige Nacht, alles schläft. When the Germans began to sing, one British person wrote, it sounded like a choir of oxen singing. They were singing a hymn. And when you sing a hymn from the heart, that's like a prayer. It's like praying to God. And the Germans were singing a hymn from their hearts. Stille Nacht, Heilige Nacht. You recognize it. You know what they were saying? A Savior, our Savior, is about to be born. They're honoring this great occasion. Then they came out of their trenches. Even to the point of bringing lighted Christmas trees with them. Think of walking out with no rifle, no protection, and the enemy is all looking at you with their sights on you, and you have a Christmas tree. And you're shouting out, Nie wieder Krieg, das falte Gott! Nie wieder Krieg, das falte Gott! No more war. That's the will of God. When they met in no man's land, as we've shown, they've depicted in this drawing, they agreed the next thing to be done was to care for the dead and the wounded. And so working side by side, they went about the no man's land taking care of their dead, burying the dead, caring for the wounded. Something that hadn't been done for 2 months. Then they met, we probably have to read this one first. One person wrote, Karl Mulick, here again we have a German writing, never was I as keenly aware of the insanity of war. And remember what the old deluder says about money? Debt and war are the most valuable ways to destroy people. Now these people start to realize, as they gather out in the middle of no man's land, they start to realize that they were lied to. And they say that in their writings. Numerous references in this book, the Silent Night book, numerous references from their journals and interviews. They started sharing pictures. This is my wife, my children, sharing as they talked with each other in no man's land. And they learned that the people on the other side, that what they were thinking were the enemy, were people just like themselves. They had families at home. They loved their families. They wanted to be there. They didn't want to be out shooting each other. They didn't hate anybody. They even exchanged gifts. Little bits of chocolate, cigarettes, whatever they had. One German, exchanged his hat. These were highly sought after. So he traded, you know, for a gift. He gave his hat to one of these other guys. But the next day, he had to come back. They had 2 days of peace. The next day, he came back to the Allied force that he'd given his hat to, and he says, "I got to have it back. We're going to have an inspection today, and I need my hat on." And then after the inspection, he returned it back to the man he'd gifted it to. All of this happened. Why did it happen? The single most important part of the book Silent Night is the title. Because over and over through the book it mentions they sang hymns. And the one most often sang was Silent Night. And when they sang the hymns from both sides singing together in their own mother tongue, we had Belgians and French and English and Germans and I don't know what else. We had non-Christians also that didn't know the words. The Turks, for example, were there. They all enjoyed this peace. And yet, it wasn't everywhere. It wasn't universal on 300 miles. In one reference, it says we could hear fierce fighting going on just 800 yards away. Here they're out in no man's land befriending the enemy, and fierce fighting's going on somewhere else along the line. These are the words. John, we have our musician here, and it's my belief that in honor of this... Well, we're going to do it anyway, whether this Easter tomorrow or not, but tomorrow is this day that we're going to represent the worship of our Lord and Savior Jesus Christ. And so we've asked John to play Silent Night. Do any of you speak German? Can you read German? I got one hand. Can she see the words? Can you see the words in German? Do you know the song Silent Night in German? Kennen Sie Stille Nacht? Okay, we got three. Do you?
No, I was just kidding.
Does she speak German?
Yeah.
Well, I didn't see a whole lot of support. I'm going to have to be our German. I'll leave the mic on. You'll hear the chorus of oxen singing. Okay, let's go for it.
Stille Nacht, heilige Nacht, alle schläft, einsam wacht, nur das traute hoch heilige Paar, holder Knabe im lockigen Schlaf in himmlischer Ruhe, schlaf in himmlischer Ruhe.
Pause just a moment. I think you all sang German. What we wanted you to do was sing English and German. So half of you sing English, and the other half sing German. Should we try that? Don't be shy. Let's feel the spirit. This brought a spirit of peace to these people. And they were able to make peace for 2 days. Let's try it again. We're going to continue the next verse, though. Go ahead.
Stille Nacht, heilige Nacht, Hirten erst, kundgemacht, durch des Hallelujah, tut es laut von fernut nach, Christ der Retter ist da, Christ der Retter ist da. Stille Nacht, heilige Nacht, Gottes Sohn, oh wie laut. baust deinem göttlichen Mut. Da uns schlägt die rettende Stund. Christ in deiner Geburt. Christ in deiner Geburt.
Thank you, John. There is a unifying force that we can bring into our lives with other people who we sometimes don't feel much unity with. And I believe part of that can be done by music. And so each month we try to bring a hymn. Last month we used this great hymn, Amazing Grace, created by a wonderful man that changed his life from a vile wretch, as he described himself, to a humble follower of Christ. And so if we use these tools that God has provided, we can gain strength, and we will feel a unity, and we will be able to accomplish good. It must be done kindly and gently with love. There's no other way that we can succeed in restoring freedom in the land. I'm going to try and present this same message I presented at the close of our last meeting. Occasionally I forget it. I pray to God that I can remember the message, because this message is powerful, and I would hope that you can submit it to memory also. I call it a conversational prayer. I try to do it with music because the music helps to bring the Spirit of God into our meeting. And so I'm going to try and say the prayer that I said last time. I've been asked to do this. And you'll see this prayer on the website if you want to read what the content is. It's just a medley, as I call it, just a gathering of thoughts from different things. Some of you will recognize the first paragraph is the preamble to the Constitution Party platform. And quite honestly, that's one thing that attracted me to their beliefs, was the preamble. Let's see if I can get our sound system to work here. I'm going to turn it down so it's not too loud, I hope. Try that. Let me see if it turns on. Let's see if we can come up with a medley of thoughts that hopefully will be a strength and a blessing to us as we go home this evening. Dear God, we the people at this Liberty and Learning Conference here in the County Commission Chambers in Salt Lake City gratefully acknowledge the blessings of our Lord and Savior Jesus Christ as Creator, Preserver, and Ruler of the universe and of these United States. We hereby appeal to Him for mercy, aid, comfort, guidance, and the protection of His providence as we work to restore and preserve these United States. Our great nation was founded not by religionists, but by Christians. Not on religions, but on the gospel of Jesus Christ. For this very reason, peoples of other faiths have been and are afforded asylum, prosperity, and freedom of worship here. This is a choice land, and whatsoever nation shall possess it shall be free from bondage and from captivity, from all other nations under heaven, if they will but serve the God of the land, who is Jesus Christ. America needs men and women of great moral courage to become involved in the political process. But moral courage of itself is not enough. We need men and women of moral courage who have prepared themselves with a working knowledge of the principles and practices of freedom as defined in our Declaration of Independence and the Constitution of the United States, according to its original intent. We do not have the luxury of retiring to our own private cloisters to pursue only our own private special interest. Strong voices are needed. The voices of those that have prepared themselves with a working knowledge of our organic documents of freedom. The weight of the stance we take may be sufficient to tip the scales in favor of truth and right. We so pray in the name of Jesus Christ. Amen. I want to the last stanza of Amazing Grace here. Let's listen to that beautiful piano playing. I told my granddaughter last week, listen to this. I want you to play like that. She's taking lessons from my wife, Grandma. Hard to say, Grandma. Think of the great words of John Newton. Amazing grace, how sweet the sound that saved a wretch like me. I once was lost, but now am found. Was blind, but now I see. And closing with a private prayer from Stephen Pratt. I love you people. God loves you. We are His children. We have something in common. We love America. Many of us love the Lord Jesus Christ. Build upon that faith and that love and strengthen your neighbor. We have a work to accomplish, to conquer the enemy of all righteousness. I pray that we may work as a team in doing that in the name of our Savior, Jesus Christ. Amen. Thank you. You're able to leave.